Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Richard Osijo, a host on New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. Joining me today is Patrick Inglis, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Grinnell College, and he's going to talk about his recent book, Narrow Fairways, Getting By and Falling Behind in the New India, about how globalization is putting the rich and poor in this developing country together in ways that are both upending and reproducing a status quo of extreme inequality. And he does it through an in-depth, long-term ethnographic examination of wealthy members of golf clubs in the city of Bangalore and the poor caddies who carry their bags. Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Rich. Thank you for having me.
So maybe just start by telling us a bit about yourself, your personal background, professional background, and just how you came to sociology.
Yeah, so I teach in the sociology department at Grinnell College. Grew up in Vancouver, Canada. And I was a high school English teacher in Vancouver, in a predominantly working class, lower middle class, area in East Vancouver. After a few years of teaching, came to New York City, to get my PhD and, you know, and eventually turned my attention to India, and this research. This research originally started as a dissertation project in 2007, many, many years ago. Yeah.
And then how did you first come to this topic? What really sparked your interest in studying these golf clubs and these caddies?
Yeah, I never thought that I would do any kind of study at a golf club, you know, let alone focus on these golf caddies. But it's sort of, you know, it came about through a lot of reading and study of the globalization literature, and what I was learning about India as a sort of focal point within that larger debate on globalization. In 2005 or 2006, Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, had come out. And I was in, like, you know, the second or third year of my PhD program. And so I sort of, you know, I wasn't so much interested in Thomas Friedman or the book, but the claims that he was making and how critics of globalization, you know, people like Mike Davis or, you know, David Harvey were taking up Friedman's ideas and really being critical of it. And so I originally planned to do a study of IT and software workers in Bangalore. Bangalore is known as the Silicon Valley of India. And Friedman's book, The World is Flat, is set in Bangalore. And one of his primary sort of cases for the flat world, and by this he means, you know, that as a result of, you know, free trade and free markets, and telecommunications innovations and whatnot, that workers in India, particularly in software and IT, were able to compete on a more level playing field. So this is his idea of the flat world. And so my idea was to go to Bangalore and actually speak to some of these IT software folks. Because he had started his book, you know, the very first page of his book, When the World is Flat, you know, at this golf course in Bangalore, the Karnataka Golf Association, the acronym, of course, being the KGA, he starts his book at this golf club and he's standing there with a billionaire CEO and they're about to tee off at the golf course at the KGA. And Friedman gets this advice from the CEO billionaire telling him to aim for the Microsoft and IBM buildings behind the first green. And so this becomes a, you know, and in defense of Friedman, right? Like, he's not writing about golf courses or anything. He's just saying, like, you know, listen, I've been coming to India for several years, you know, a couple decades back and forth. And you know, lo and behold, I see these IT giants, these buildings around this golf course. He actually mentions his golf caddy on page 2, I believe. And then he's, you know, he tells us this story of, you know, lying in bed at night and he's not able to sleep and turns over and, you know, says to his wife, honey, I think the world is flat. So when I wanted to study IT and software workers, I thought, you know, why not start at this golf course? There is an IT tech park right behind it, as mentioned in Friedman's book. And so I thought, I'll just sort of use this as one of multiple sites of entry. And then over time, you know, I started playing golf and I got to know the members and eventually got to know the caddies. And I realized that there was a more interesting story about the interaction and relationships between the rich and poor. And in these specific sites, these golf clubs, between the wealthy members and the poor lower caste golf caddies. So that's how it got going. It took many, many months though, to really figure out the question. I can talk more about that if you'd like and how it evolved. But yeah, this is the idea. It wasn't so much about Friedman. It was about the critical response to Friedman in the academic scholarly literature that I was really sort of trying to debate and truly engage with.
Yeah. Tell us more about that, because it is a very novel approach, I think, to studying the on the ground consequences of globalization. Because, yeah, like you said, on the one hand, we have the more Friedman school or camp, the notion that India has benefited from globalization. And then on the other, we have this notion that globalization has created so-called two Indias, or, you know, two other developing worlds coexisting but never interacting. The vast majority of people in these countries haven't felt much of whatever prosperity globalization has brought. But you came to understand the situation through your work at these golf clubs between the members and the caddies very differently. It wasn't so much the separation as it was this kind of really deep intertwining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that critics of globalization misunderstand and get wrong about the effects of globalization, and let's just be clear on what those effects are, right? When you emphasize and celebrate free markets and free trade and the sort of limited regulatory role of the state, you know, there are inequalities that can follow. But what the critics of globalization in these processes are really trying to argue is that this inequality that is produced is forcing a physical, social, economic separation between rich and poor. And over the course of my research and getting to know these members and caddies and actually observing them on the golf courses, I mean, through the research, I learned to play golf. I took a membership at the KGA and I played at all these golf courses, and actually observing their interactions and the result of their interactions, I came to see the effects of globalization differently, right? That when you privatize education, healthcare, housing, that the poor are sort of necessarily obligated to draw themselves closer to the rich, and this is an ideal case, if you will, and it's extreme case, but there are multiple cases across India and across the global South, and I would even argue even in the United States today, this is happening more and more, where poor and working class people are not able to provide for themselves in ways that, to put food on the table, roofs over their heads, without some kind of relationship with others, right? And when the state is sort of stepping back from that role, who assumes that role? Well, in the case of the golf caddies, they work these relationships with the wealthy members, and so what the wealthy members do in return is if they like and get along with the caddy, they will provide their caddy and often a couple different caddies, support for schooling, for healthcare, for housing, for food. They will provide them with you know, interest-free loans, let's say. If a brother or a sister falls ill, they'll pay for a surgery. And so what you have is the nation state stepping back, and you have these wealthy members in this case sort of stepping forward, if you will, and providing a degree of support that the caddies can't find anywhere else. And so that's what I'm saying. I mean, and this is an extreme case, as I say, but this is what I'm trying to show in the book, is that rather than globalization pulling rich and poor apart, it's actually, you know, it's actually deepening their ties to one another. And I think that there are extreme consequences to that as well. I mean, it's good in the short term because these caddies do get some kind of support, but there's also deeper questions that I get to later in the book about, like, you know, civil society and how we support one another and whether or not globalization is providing the conditions that it can allow people to really become truly independent. And that's not something that I found in this case.
Yeah, and we get a very vivid example of this right from the jump. The first person we meet in the book on the first page is a caddy named Krishna, who describes the club where he works, which is the KGA, as you mentioned, as his school. The KGA is my school. And it's an eye-opening statement for me and for other readers, I'm sure, but also for you, as you show. So what did he mean by that? And what really kind of stood out for you when you heard him say that and when you thought about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. You write it, obviously, it starts on the first page, and I mentioned this. But just a little bit of a background. I mean, I had spent a few months leading up to this very point. Really, I had hired a golf caddy who was coaching at the sort of public driving range in the center of the city, and this caddy I named Ravi in the book. And he's a golf caddy at the Bangalore Golf Club. And so for several months, we had just been meeting several times a week at 6:30 or 7 in the morning, and I'd just be practicing golf. And as I was practicing golf, you know, in this driving public driving range where all the members from the different clubs came, I got to know the members. And then, you know, within a week or two, they were inviting me to sit on the clubhouse patios and chat with them. And so, you know, and I carried out dozens of interviews, often with alcohol involved, you know, sipping whiskey in these, you know, private, exclusive, clubhouse patios, and not really paying attention much to the interactions between the members I was speaking with and their caddies or even the wait staff or anything else, and hadn't really spoken to anyone who was part of the caddy class other than Ravi for several months. And then when I was in New York for the summer, this is summer of 2007, and I come back and I take up this six month membership at the KGA. And on the first round, Krishna is paired with me, or actually I say paired with me, but he picked me out. And this often happens with the caddies. They, you know, I'm tall, middle class, white, to him and to anybody else, I would have appeared wealthy, although I was just a grad student. Certainly relative to him, I was wealthy. And he sort of works a relationship, and he picks up my bag when I arrive at the golf course, and then we're on our way. And we were walking up the seventh fairway, and it just sort of strikes me the entire time we're speaking English, right? So he wasn't 100% fluent and proficient in the language, but we were getting by. And I just asked him, like, you know, how did you learn English? And he kind of looks at me as if this is a stupid question, and perhaps it was. And he says, my school is the KGA. And you know this, Rich, as doing ethnographic work there, you can be kind of fumbling around in the dark for many, many weeks or months trying to figure out what the question is here. But when he said this to me, my school is the KGA, I took a notebook out of my pocket, and I wrote it down and I circled it. And I thought that is the project. Like, what is Krishna learning here, right? Like, you know, he really was just referring to the language, to learning English, but I sort of spun it, you know, differently. He wasn't just learning a language. He was learning how to live and survive in this context. He was learning how to relate to the members. He was developing a set of aspirations as a response to his interactions with them. There were a whole host of things that he was learning. And so I, for the purpose of the project, I wanted to learn what he was learning. And so he became one of several caddies that I got to know. This was in, I believe, September 2007. And over the next few months, I started rolling out these interviews, a series of more formal interviews with the golf caddies. And I kept up the interviews with the members. But there were three golf clubs. There's the KGA, as we've already talked about. There's the Bangalore Golf Club. And then there's this private club called the Eagleton Golf Resort. And that's outside of the city. And so I got to know those. I got to know the caddies at each of these three golf clubs. And I roll out a series of interviews. It was sort of two rounds with about 15 to 20 of them at each of the golf clubs. Then I also did a more involved survey with each group of caddies. So although I only interviewed formally, say, 20 to 25 or so caddies from each of the clubs, I sat down with up to 100 of the caddies and asked them sort of basic questions about their family background and education and where they live and these kinds of things. So that's and then this sort of takes me through basically a year of field work, just focused on the caddies. Now, because I spoke to so many of the caddies, for the purpose of the book, I didn't want, and we read some of these ethnographies where five or six different people are quoted in every page, and I didn't want to do that. In a way, I sort of sacrificed breadth, and for depth. I wanted to get to know, a few of these caddies really, really well, and Krishna was one of them. So the book is really centered and focused on about 8 to 10 different caddies, as opposed to the dozens and dozens that I got to know. So, and each of the chapters is organized around a couple different caddies throughout the book. That's how the work unfolded.
Yeah, I mean it's a great example that really kind of humanizes a lot of the structural conditions that you're engaging with in the book, and right from the outset, I think it works really well. So going forward, then the title of the first chapter is The Caddy Question, which you get from one of the club's archives from like over 100 years ago, in reference to a discussion about whether the club should hire caddies as employees instead of this more informal, quasi-legal caddy management system that they had been using. And it's an issue that carries on to this day, and you show how the caddies have kind of periodically over those 100 years organized to try to improve their work conditions, only to eventually just let it go. So tell us, what explains why these efforts of collective action only end up reinforcing this precarious system of labor management that is used by the clubs?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, I get into the archives of the KGA and the Bangalore Golf Club. They grant me permission to read the records, and I discover that at around the turn of the 20th century, more than 100 years ago, the Bangalore Golf Club, the members that sit on their advisory board are having a conversation about the caddies, and it turns out that they're really struggling to get caddies to come to the club. And so it comes up, why don't we pay these guys? Why don't we put them on the books and make them regular employees, and that'll compel them to come, right? If they're employees, they have to come. And that's something that really it comes up a few times in the conversations, in the minutes to these meetings that I had access to, but it never really gains much traction, and it loses all traction altogether, 100 years later on the turn of the 21st century, because of the labor conditions just in Bangalore and in the country are such that 80 to 90% of all labor in India is in the informal sector, right? So. And what that means is that people are not given, guaranteed contracts. They don't have much job security. Oftentimes they're paid in cash as opposed to direct deposits and bank accounts. They may or may not have access to healthcare benefits. They certainly don't have a pension, et cetera. But also, I mean, in the turn of the 21st century, you have hundreds of millions of more workers that are available, right, to any kind of firm, formal, informal, small and large. And so these golf clubs now have access to a pool of residual labor that is oftentimes living very much at the gates of these clubs, right? And so from the side of the clubs, they don't want to enter into any kind of formal arrangement or agreement with this pool of labor, because it doesn't, one is there's the financial hit it might take, right? But there's also, for the members, there's a political question here. you know, if we roll these caddies into our, you know, into the books and formalize their our contract and agreement with them, we may in fact invite, you know, union activity in the club. And so, this is actually wrong on the facts, but there's something to it that the clubs feel that if they don't name the caddies employees, if they keep calling them casual or contract labor, as they do, both in writing and in their conversations with me, that the caddies have no basis or grounds to appeal for anything more formal, right? And it was one of the early puzzles for me that the caddies, you know, and some of the, there are a few members, of course, that do treat the caddies very well, but I would say the majority don't. And even for the caddies who are treated well, right, there's a degree of precarity and informality about their lives, right? Like where they live, where they might send their kids to school, whether they have health, you know, healthcare expenses, you know, and they're sort of compelled necessarily to perform these extreme acts of servility and deference at the side of these members if they want to live and support their families. And so it sort of struck me as odd, like, because I'd meet with the caddies and they, you know, and these would be private conversations, and they'd say what the members say to them and what they feel about the relationship, et cetera. And then I'd find that they didn't seem all that interested in organizing to form any kind of, you know, union, or if they do form some kind of collective action, it's in a way to kind of further cement the status quo, right? And the status quo being, you know, we as caddies get to show up at the golf course, and we don't want to be told what to do. We want to have some kind of degree of autonomy to set up our relationships with the members and let that sort of proceed. But of course the members and the clubs don't necessarily allow that full autonomy, right? So the clubs will say that they're contract casual laborers and that these guys can just kind of come and go as they like. But that's actually not true in reality. Each of the clubs has a caddy master who's oftentimes a former caddy who's been elevated into a kind of paid formal managerial position at the club, and his responsibility is to ensure that there's a member there's a caddy for any member who wants one, right? So the caddy can often intervene in these relationships and say, no, you're not going with Patrick, you're going with someone else, right? And Krishna was really, really upset about this. And so we had a series of conversations about the caddy masters and the club and what they demanded of him, right? And not just that he go with a particular member, even though he didn't want to, but that he had to wear a uniform, right? That he would be liable for you know, being suspended if a member complained. Like, there's all these kinds of ways that the clubs act as formal institutions in control of the labor process. And Krishna was very aware of this and wanted to transform it. But when we kept on coming to these conversations, and we did so over a few different years. And I think in 2010, I'm back in Bangalore and I'm having dinner with him and his family, and said, well, you know, if you're so upset about this and disappointed in the members, why don't you organize the caddies and do something about it, right? Like why don't you, you know, if they're going to treat you as formal employees, why don't you argue that you can become formal employees? And he's like, no, like, he doesn't want that at all, right? Like, what he really wants is he wants just a little bit more autonomy and independence from these caddy masters who he sources as the main problem, right? It doesn't appear to him I think it appears to him that some kind of collective action might be warranted, but he also, like, if you play it out, and we did, you know, just speaking with one another, right? Like, if you push it so far, you could become formal employees, and then you can get guaranteed wages, and you can get healthcare and a pension, and you can plan for things, and you know every couple of weeks or once a month you get money in a bank account, right? Like, this would be better. And he's like, no, like, I, like, he always thought that he could make more money given the way things were than in a situation where he would have to kind of forfeit that independence. I mean, and as it was, you know, and any caddy who's been there for a long time wants to develop a relationship, a close, you know, bond with a group of, say, 5 to 6 members. And, you know, Krishna calls them good members. But if you're a formal employee, you would potentially lose out on that, right? Like, you would more and more have to go with the people that may not even give you much of a tip at the end of the day. Whereas right now, you know, he's sort of balancing, like, I don't get everything I want. And sometimes the caddies tell me to do things I don't want to do. And sometimes members treat me badly, but the alternative is much worse. And so, I think that sort of challenges some of the ways we think about informality and precarity in the Global South, but also in the Global North, about what laborers want, right? And also what they imagine might be possible for them, and what the conditions of an organized collective struggle might be. And I think we assume, and as I did many, many years ago, that these caddies would of course want to, you know, form a union and really try to struggle to be formally recognized as employees of these golf clubs. But that's in fact not what they wanted at all.
Yeah, it's a really big example, I think, of how this status quo gets reproduced. It's very well done, that analysis. So the caddies do get most of the focus, I'd say, in the book, but when it comes to the elite members of the clubs themselves, it's really quite fascinating that so many of them have certainly benefited from globalization, from these liberalization policies and so on. But many of them are quite critical of India's direction in toward liberalization and are very sympathetic toward the conditions of India's masses, who they see are getting caught up in these globalizing forces in ways that are often very harmful. But at the same time, these members don't seem to have very much sympathy at all for the plights of the specific caddies who work for them, who they see all the time. What explains that? Why is there that disconnect between their recognition and criticism toward globalization and their lack of it when it comes to the people who they interact with on a daily basis?
Well, I mean, the short answer is simply that actually, transforming systems and structures, beginning with the club, in ways that might suit the interests and benefit the caddies more, would be a direct threat to them. So that's the short answer here. But you're right. Like there was something kind of puzzling, because remember that there were those few months where I was just hanging out with members, right? And I was going to their parties and their restaurants that they owned, or hanging out within the clubhouses and getting to know them and their families. And there were these conversations we would have about the poor and about the state of India. And this is the mid 2000s and then beyond, right? And there was actually one guy who was highly, highly critical of Thomas Friedman's book. He's like, this is just absolute garbage. This is not true at all, right? Like, you can't talk about a flat world and have, you know, farmers committing suicide and the level of inequality and poverty we have, et cetera. And then when I switched to the focus to talk about the caddies, and then I would ask the members to respond or to reflect on their interactions with the caddies, there was this shift in their way of thinking. And what I figured out, or what I understood what was happening, was that there was this deep sympathy and almost radical progressivism that the members could adopt when talking about the poor, the kind of abstract category of the poor that existed and lived and labored beyond the walls of the golf clubs. But for the caddies, they perceived the caddies as actually having a lot of opportunities. And the first opportunity was to serve them, obviously. That they could be learning English, right? That they were getting cash in hand at the end of every day. That this was a privilege to work with them, and that if the caddies weren't coming up, that any individual caddy who was still failing after several years and in some cases decades on the job, that wasn't the member's fault and it wasn't the club's fault. It was the fault of these individual caddies. And I think, you know, part of it, as I said earlier a couple of minutes ago, is that there's a kind of self-preservation here, right? Like, you know, what would it really mean for the members to take seriously how these caddies are living, right? Beyond helping any one specific caddy out, right? It would mean, more fees at the golf course. It would mean a kind of democratization, if you will, of the golf club. and maybe even at a certain point, not even such a thing as a private golf club. Like you would have a public course, right? Like there's a whole series of things, both financial, political, and social, that that would follow if they took seriously what was happening with these caddies. And so rather than take seriously what's going on with these caddies, what they do is they sort of, you know, deliberately and consciously, you know, try to seek out caddies that achieve or you know, fulfill some kind of ideal notion of the, you know, deserving poor, right? So you've got caddies who can, because of their own sort of minor advantages here and there, can dress a little bit better, who bathe more regularly, let's say, or brush their teeth, or you know, and et cetera. And those caddies are the ones who get selected by the members to be their caddies. And those caddies, if they have a good working relationship with a series of members, can actually do okay for themselves. And what happens is over time, the members start to point to these caddies as the success cases. But also what happens is that the caddies who are successful, they don't think of their advantages and their success as having anything to do with fortune or luck, right? And of course it does, because if you just show up at the golf course on any given day, you may or may not meet with somebody who's going to change, you know, who's going to transform your life. But they don't think in those terms. They think that actually I have done something in my presentation of self and how I actually work with this member on the golf course to deserve or warrant this kind of economic and social attention. And so this presents a real struggle for the collective solidarity of the class of caddies, right? Because any one caddy, if he's smart and rational about it, right, is not interested so much in developing a kind of collective action or solidarity with the caddies who are at his level. Their interest is to develop and deepen this solidarity with the members, right? This is structural, right? Because the actual conditions for real substantive change just aren't necessarily in the cards.
Yeah, and the so-called success stories engage in these strategies, this upward servility, a term that you use and that you mentioned a little bit earlier, that allows some of them to advance, but being unable to truly break free from the extreme acts of servility and deference that the members expect of them, right?
Yeah. There's, you know, I have chapter 6, which is about this one caddy named Ganesh, and I got to know Ganesh and his family beginning in, you know, in about the spring of 2008, because I did a series of more formal interviews, but what came out of those interviews was, you know, I sort of shared mutual trust with a few of the caddies who became the sort of central figures of the book, and Ganesh was one of them. And I meet Ganesh on the golf course. I'm playing golf. I've got a caddy, and he's working with a member who had become a professional coach, and it was making a lot of money and doing very well at it. And I could tell that there was something really interesting and special about the relationship between Ganesh and this member. And this member was working with somebody on the golf course who was learning golf. And so Ganesh was just hired to carry the bag for the person that this member, this professional coach, was helping out. And over time, it was interesting for me to track the relationship between the member and Ganesh. And they spoke very, very well of each other. I mean, the member, says, oh, he's going to be okay if he's with me. And he was. And actually, Ganesh grew up in the neighboring state of Tamil Nadu and had a very sort of, you know, hard luck story to tell of extreme poverty, and his family moves to Bangalore in the mid to late 1980s because there was a lot of development and growth, actually, you know, physically around the golf course. I'll leave this tech park and the developments coming up. But for the first, you know, the first little while that Ganesh and his family is living there when he's really young, I mean, they're eating broken rice, split rice, and, you know, dead worms, and they're living in very, very poor conditions at the side of this open, you know, sewer. And then he starts to work with the member, and over time the member helps to invest, and, you know, he helps get him out of the slum, and he eventually gets into a second story apartment. And so, you know, Ganesh has come up quite literally as a result of this relationship with this member, as well as a few other members. Over time, I noticed that Ganesh is not able to really reconcile his extreme dependence on this member and the other members with a kind of guilt and shame for that, right? Like, he can never be fully independent. I don't know if I want to give the chapter away, but there's a there's a sort of sad case that unfolds that results in the separation of Ganesh and this member. And it just sort of goes to show that as much as the members might say that they care, and in this case, this one particular member did care greatly about Ganesh, that they're only willing to go so far, that they're not going to transform the structural conditions of these guys' lives, right? This is not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that example in particular certainly calls the question of the sustainability of some of these relationships, and given the face of the structural conditions that they encounter. So when we talk about social mobility in India, I guess the legacy of the caste system is obviously quite integral. And, you know, you approach that, and while the caddies say that caste does not play an important role in the clubs, you find a lot of ways that show how it does. What are some examples of how you saw caste and the legacy of caste still influencing this emerging so-called meritocratic capitalist system in India?
Well, there's a chapter called Caste Illa, and in that caste illa just means in Kannada, which is the language of Karnataka, and you know, Karnataka is the state where Bangalore is the capital. In Kannada, caste illa means caste is not there. And what I noticed is both the members and the caddies were almost reading off the same script, right? Both of them said caste didn't matter. And at one level, it was true, because, you know, in the space of the clubs, right, like, no member would ever say that I select or choose a caddy based on his caste background. No caddy would say that he's only going to go with a particular member because of caste, right? But of course, caste predicts who's going to be a member and who's going to be a caddy. I've got a few different chapters that deal with the question of caste, but in this particular one, I noticed that, you know, through the stories of these two guys, Arjun and Sampath, who are, well, now as of today, probably they're in their mid-40s, but when I meet them, they're 12, 13 years ago, and they're raising their families, and they live at the back of this village, Chelgata, which is directly adjacent to the IT park that I'd mentioned when we first started our conversation here, and also opposite the backside of the KGA. And for them, they told me stories of growing up poor at the back of this village, and the upper caste wealthier families would live in the center of this village. And, you know, they would be sort of like, they'd be obligated to go to the upper caste homes during, you know, festivals or birthdays and sort of give out gifts. And these upper caste people who would, you know, who would live in these homes would sort of, you know, drop candy and not, you know, from windowsills, and be sure that they didn't touch these guys. And what the KGA provided them when it comes up in the late 1980s is quite literally an exit, or like a reason to leave, right? One of them stayed through high school and finished, but at a very, very poorly resourced government school at Sampath. And the other one, Arjun, he drops out in the third grade. But both of them, you know, early in their teens, start to carry bags and become golf caddies at this golf course, right? And so they're able to physically leave the space of Chelgata and come into a space that to them provides them, you know, a kind of opportunity and a degree of respect that is based on what they do and not who they are, right? So, But later in the book, in other chapters, like, I kind of show that these caste identities and where they live are are not so easily dismissed, and they can't be overcome all that easily. In the case of Arjun, for example, he had said all along, as Sampath did, that that caste illit, caste is not there. But by the end of the book, I'm showing that because of caste, because of the geography of the village and where he lives, he's got generations of family that live back there with him. And even though he's come up a little bit and making some money, over time he becomes a professional golfer, and that's a sort of, we can talk about that. But he makes some money, but that by the end of the book, he's had an injury and he can't keep playing. But he'd love to leave Shalgata, but he can't because of his family. And he talks about, quote, bloody relationships, which for me was really interesting. Like they're like, bloody having multiple meanings. One is like, damn it, I don't want to have these ties, but also just at a genetic level that there were these blood ties with his families that he couldn't leave behind, right? So there were the opportunities in the space of the clubs, but also like these guys and how their lives are formed geographically, economically, or socially make it really tough for them to overcome, right? There's a glimpse of possibility, certainly in their aspirations and what they observe of the members and how they hear the members speak about themselves and their lives. But for them, like it's actually not, their lives in most cases are not transformed all that much over time.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read about these, the echoes of this stratification system still influencing them.
Like even, the education that they're able to provide for their kids, right? Like, caste has a hugely predictive, force in this realm as well. Like Arjun is only able to, at the start of it, when his children are young and I'm just getting to know them, I mean, he's sending his kids to a nominally private school, right? And it's kind of a racket across India that you have these schools called private schools. But really what they do is they take a little bit of money each month from a number of poor people within a local area. And because they're only taking a little bit of money and they're not very well resourced and they don't provide great education, right? So, but those are the kind of schools that these caddies have access to for their children, right? And what I notice is, and we can talk about this if you want, but there was really only one case that I came across where a member wanted to ensure that the caddy could educate his kids to the same level that the member would educate his own kids. In the vast majority of cases, members are helping a little bit with these nominally private schools, right? That are very poorly resourced and kids and eventually fail out. They don't do very well. But there was only one case where a member that I observed, like actually got a caddy's kids into schools that he would send his own kids to, right? And so, so we can talk about there are members who arrive in Mercedes Benzes and BMWs and they dress well and they're sending their kids to Europe, for golf lessons even or schools and in some cases they're treating their caddies kind of well, but they're actually not committing to education for the caddies' kids so that the caddies' kids don't end up being like caddies. And in some cases, the caddies' kids do. They drop out of school and they become caddies like their fathers.
Yeah, now the long-term trajectory is, yeah, it's a real benefit of an ethnography like this one, about a decade or so of research, that you really get to see how they play out over time. And, it's here that we really see this ideology of individualism, based on individual achievements, predicated on hard work, and how it really colors how the caddies make sense of the paths they've taken and been on, and where they find themselves, as well as where they find their peers, whether that reflects upward or downward social mobility. So you've got some great stories that you've been hinting at of their lives and their families. Mm-hmm. So what are then some of the major outcomes and how they interpret them?
A short answer. I mean, most of the caddies, they assume that they're failures if they consider themselves to be a failures. And I wouldn't say that they're failures. I think that how their lives have followed are a result of, structural inequalities. But for them, how they understand their lives is that they've it's either bad luck you know, or they just haven't done enough, right? To warrant, you know, success. You mentioned the long-term aspect of this study. I mean, I started in 2007, and I was still doing interviews and following up with guys in 2018. So 10, 11 years there. And the advantage of it, as you say, is that I can track these guys over time, but it's not just them that I'm tracking over time. It's their children that I'm tracking over time. When I meet the caddies, you know, Ganesh was a good example of this. Same with Arjun and Sampath. When I meet these guys in 2007, 2008, and then they're inviting me into their homes. And by the way, maybe we should have said this earlier. I'm accompanied on these home community visits with people who are providing, you know, translation, interpretation work, right? So, you know, there are guys like Krishna and all the caddies really that I can have English conversations with, but the kind of deep nitty gritty sort of analytical stuff, I had to have some help with that, because I had a few words of Kannada and Tamil, but I did not speak the languages well enough to actually, you know, converse with these guys over long term. But again, going back to this, like when I meet the caddies and their kids, they're saying that their kids, in Sampath's case, for example, he says that he has two boys, that they may not become, they may not work in careers and earn salaries that where they could that are gonna be like the members, right? But maybe his kids' kids, right, his grandkids eventually might be able to work in these members' offices, right? Like under them, like as salary professionals, that over time they would improve. And they become, you know, they become accountants, lawyers, IT software was really big. All these caddies, a lot of them, maybe not all of them, you know, even though they didn't know really what IT and software work was about, they wanted their kids to grow up and be IT software workers. So this is, you know, and their kids are 4, 5, 6, 7 years of age, right? And then 10 years passes, and I'm visiting them every year or so, right? And spending summers with them and hanging out and speaking with them. And it was really sad in the case of Sampath. I mean, he has a son who is today a golf caddy at the same course that his father was a caddy at. You know, he failed out of his 10th grade exams. He hated school. I mean, the schools that he was going to weren't very good. And so this is a sort of clear example of how the poor are kind of reproducing themselves, right, generation after generation. And it was quite sad and heartbreaking to see to follow this over time, right? I would have preferred that things turn out differently, right, for these caddies and their families. And for the majority of them, that's not true. For the ones that were able to get their kids somewhat, you know, decently educated, like they, and we mentioned this earlier, they end up assuming that it's a result of their hard work that the members have helped them out in this way. And there's this effort to sort of separate themselves, right, at the level of rhetoric and, you know, at interactionally and socially, from the caddies who they deem as unsuccessful or failures. And so there's this ideology that is at work and at play at this level among the caddies themselves about who gets ahead and why and why others don't, right? And leaving aside these structural questions. And of course, as a sociologist, it's my job, I suppose, to sort of tease out those structural conditions and stuff and that predict these kinds of things and why things turn out the way they do. But also just at a human level, it has been kind of heartbreaking to follow and track over time, yeah, I would say.
So you've talked a little bit already about all the field work that you did and the people you spoke with. So why don't you tell us a bit more about what it was like in terms of the obstacles, the challenges, the experiences that you had studying these folks, given your own background and given the people who you were studying, the context you were in?
Yeah, I would... methodologically, it was challenging and difficult because I had three golf courses, and we kind of really only talked about the KGA. And of course, I would hope that people listening to this would go get the book and read about the other golf clubs. But so, like, you know, traversing the city, you know, and sometimes daily, but also coming in and out of homes and getting to know people. And I also, like, I was invited to hang out with the caddies and their families. Like if they took bus trips outside of the city to go, you know, visit their extended family in faraway villages, I would do that. And so there was a there's a sort of physical labor involved with the methodological work. I don't want to leave out the question of positionality, my own positionality as a white white male, you know, PhD educated, middle class. That I believe certainly opened doors for me. I mean, I've mentioned that the clubs provided me access to their private records. They and everything was on the up and up as far as I was concerned. I mean, I got letters of support from them, and they knew what I was doing the whole time. But I've had some friends in India and elsewhere tell me that, you know, if I had been black or brown, right, if I had been somebody who didn't speak fluent English, not middle class, I would not have been given that kind of latitude. So that certainly helped. On the flip side is, you know, interacting with the caddies who occupy a very, very different class position. I mentioned earlier that, you know, on the basis of a kind of shared mutual trust, we sort of started out this arrangement, and they kind of knew what I was doing. But also a challenge was to sort of convince them that them telling me their stories was somehow going to, give them greater insight into their own lives and might not necessarily produce. I never promised any great transformational change in their lives or in the course of the golf clubs, but that it would add to our sort of collective understanding of how class and inequality worked. But, you know, in many cases, these guys were illiterate. If they were literate and had been educated, they didn't necessarily, you know, speak or write English. I did have to hire translators to work with me. And that, you know, access is an ongoing process. It's not like you get into somebody's home and then you can assume that you're going to have access to their home and their family lives, you know, for 10 years in my case. I didn't have that. I didn't believe that to be true. And so you could just continue to work these relationships. But, you know, as I'm doing the research, I mentioned the physical labor, and I sort of finished off on a previous point about the sort of the sort of human piece of this and the moral piece of this. I mean, it was sort of tough to track and follow these guys' lives. And at a certain point, I mean, we know when we go watch a movie or we watch a show on television, we kind of know at a certain point how the show or the movie is going to end. And I did in some cases, and I did in all cases at a certain point, although it came at different points in the research. But and sort of just knowing that I wanted to see how that played out, and knowing that there wasn't much that I could do as an individual researcher to change the trajectory of these guys' lives, right? As a way of gaining and keeping access, and I was genuine and sincere in this, I would help caddies out, right? Like I'd bring some food over, I'd help their children with homework, I would buy gifts for their wives, I mean, I would do certain things, but there's also like I could never repay them for what they've offered me, and I mean, they provided me a career very, very clearly, and so. And we can talk about like what we owe our research subjects and the sort of politics and ethics of ethnography. And I mean, and we're running out of time too. Maybe that's a story for another day or another podcast. But yeah, that's a bit about my own positionality and how I sort of interacted and related to the members, but also the caddies, and sort of kept up these relationships over time with them.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yes. Another day, another time. Because we're running out of time, but. Before we go, why don't you tell us what directions you're taking this work in, or what just the next project is, the next step in analyzing some of these issues?
So I have two research projects ongoing right now. One is sort of, you might make more sense just on the surface. There, in 2014, I became acquainted with a private foundation that educates poor lower caste children, and so I became acquainted with them and got to know them, and it was founded by a former Wall Street executive, and this residential boarding school is located in a sort of small village community a couple hour drive outside of Bangalore in Tamil Nadu, and I was initially skeptical of the founder and just this, the role of philanthropy might be playing in these kids' lives and who was really benefiting, based on what I was learning about the members and what the members were or were not doing for these golf caddies. But in this case, I mean, and I'm happy to say that this founder and what he's doing is remarkable. And the kids who going to the school are coming from desperately extremely poor families, but are finishing high school and speaking fluent English, and they're going to some of the best schools, best colleges, universities in Bangalore. Some of them are getting their MBAs in Asia and in Europe. That project is really trying to like take seriously the efforts by privately funded organizations and groups like this one to really stem inequality and to attend to poverty alleviation. So that project, I think, over time, my goal here is to track the graduates over time and to see how their lives have become transformed or how they evolve, right? And I guess one question is like, do they want to go back to their poor families and support their families and lift their families out of poverty? Certainly, that's one of the objectives that the founder of the organization has for them. But how do they negotiate and navigate those relationships with people who are still struggling with poverty? And so the sort of legacy of philanthropy in the case of this school. And then I have a second project that's really, really just in its early stages. It's about the Mexican elite. And that's the one that might appear like a complete 180, right, from what I've been doing previously, both with the education work I've just outlined, and as well as the book on the golf caddies and the members of these golf clubs. But how I try to narrate this and think about it in my own writing around the project is like, what I was dealing with in the case of the caddies and the members was something very micro-interactional. And I was looking at the effects and consequences in many cases of globalization on the lives of the poor, and how globalization was deeply embedded and sort of guided and organized these relationships between the rich and the poor. And in the case of Mexico, I'm sort of going like much more macro, right? Like I'm trying to understand neoliberalism and how it unfolded in Mexico in the 1980s and 1990s, and how a certain class of elites, the political and economic elite, sort of brought about those changes and have benefited from those changes, and whether or not others in the society as a whole has benefited, so that you get to a point, 30, 40 years later, where social mobility in Mexico is, and there's a huge debate on this, but the literature that I'm seeing is saying that, there's not much social mobility even 25 years after signing NAFTA in the mid 1990s. Wages are pretty much stagnant. Inequality is tremendous, right? Like you've got 4 billionaires in Mexico who account for around 9% of GDP, right? There's just enormous class divides. So I started the first project on the golf caddies with like looking at Thomas Friedman and this idea of a flat world, and sort of coming back at that and taking that really seriously. Like, where does this idea come from, and how did it evolve and develop in the space of Mexico? What does this mean for the study of globalization and political economy generally? That's what that work is about.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. Good luck with those projects. And whenever those books come out, please come back.
Okay.
And we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rich. Bye.